This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help bringing out the best in your pet's behavior, we want to hear from you at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And Patricia, in addition to the calls this hour, you'll be sharing another topic with us.
That's right. We're going to talk this week about the ethics of zoos. You know, some people say they're inhumane. Other people argue they have great educational conservation benefits. So a little later on this hour, we're going to explore those viewpoints and discuss what makes a good zoo
zoo. That should be very interesting. And we'll also welcome a guest who had a hand in rescuing 1,800 wild horses from one of the most dangerous places on Earth, the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. That's still ahead later this hour. But first, should we take some calls?
I'm here. I'm ready.
Let's do that. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Leslie from Dallas, Texas.
Hi, Leslie. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is, I am a second-year master's student in opera performance at the University of North Texas. And being an opera performance, I need to be able to practice my music at home a lot. My dilemma is that I have a lovely little one-year-old male dachshund that absolutely loves to sing along with me. And it's gotten so bad that I can't even sing a couple of notes without him joining in. And so I was wondering if there was anything I can do to get him to stop howling when I sing.
Now, wait a minute. Have you recorded any of this?
I have. We have, you know, on our digital camera, sometimes we'll record it. And it used to be really cute, but frankly now it's just gotten to be a little bit of a nuisance.
Isn't it often true that something that starts out cute turns into this big irritation after a while?
You know, you could sing this for us right now. Is the dog right there?
Yeah, he is.
Oh, let's hear.
Samson, Samson.
I love it.
Thank you. First of all, I do love you.
Your voice is wonderful.
Thank you.
It was all Larry and I could do to keep from howling along. With the whole group in sort of joy and communal vocal ecstasy. My first piece of advice got wiped out by that demonstration, because what I was going to say is what I've learned is the perfect way to eliminate a behavior problem in your pet is to get out a video camera and try to record it. Because as soon as you're ready with a video camera, they won't do it anymore. And it's worked over and over and over. So you just buy a video, you put it in your pocket, carry it with you. But obviously, this is not going to work.
Ain't it going to work.
With this particular dachshund.
Yes.
And given that dogs are predisposed genetically to vocalize together, you know? I mean, wolves howl, dogs bark. When other dogs bark, this is just what dogs do. So trying to train your dog to be silent on cue when you're singing is a really tough one. So the first thing I do is a logistical solution. Let's teach your dachshund to go in a room very, very far away and go into his or her crate in a back room and chew on a wonderful little doggy toy, you know, a bone you got from a pet store. If you can do this to take him outside, if there's an outdoor area that's fenced where he's safe, get him a real bone. You know, you can give dogs real bones if they're not cooked and if they're the right kind. You don't want a long bone. You want like a big joint bone. Give him that, and he's going to be like, I don't care what she's doing, man. You know, I'm chewing on something really good out here. So I would deal with this logistically. It's a perfectly reasonable way to do it. Don't feel badly about it. That's what the professional trainers would do. It's like, how can I logistically fix this problem?
Okay.
And good luck with your singing.
Thank you so much.
You have a beautiful voice. Thank you very much, Leslie. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, we heard from Lynn in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, who faces a situation we hear about all too often on Calling All Pets, and here's what she writes. I really do love my husband, even though I couldn't immediately respond to his threat, it's the cat or me.
Uh-oh.
Our cat, Turbo, is a 14-year-old male who's been urinating in inappropriate places. The latest was on the kids' backpacks that were on the floor in the kitchen.
Ooh.
We've taken Turbo to the vet, and the vet ruled out any physical issues. He says it must be behavioral. We've already tried using a feel-away pheromone spray and the plug-in, and neither has helped. We have a three-story home, so he's found many corners on each floor to urinate on. Is there anything I can do with or for my cat before he meets the great kitty heaven?
Ooh, this is serious. And I, you know, over 20 years, I've heard about a lot of these. And it's, in her husband's defense, it is really hard to live in a house that is full of urine or feces.
It's really smelly.
Really is hard. You know, I have a dog who's incontinent right now. And that's just the way it's going to be. And when she's ready to go, you know, then I'll help her go. But she's not ready yet. So I do a lot of cleaning up right now. And, you know, it's just tough. It's just tough. So here's some ideas. And I want to preface this by saying there's no way with a case this serious, and this is life and death, that I can in 3 minutes just sort of magically fix this problem.
Okay.
What I can do is one, tell you that in most cases, maybe 90%+, you're going to be able to make this much, 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 much better. Can you get this down to zero? I don't know. That's a little tougher. But can you make it so that it almost never happens? You do have a good chance of that. So the litter box litany I have to do first, and it well may be that she's done all of these things, but one three-story house. Ooh, how many boxes? Absolutely a box on each floor, without question. In really serious cases, if you can stand it temporarily, this might be tricky with your husband, is two boxes on each floor. Basically, you want to put boxes pretty much everywhere so that the cat has an infinite number of appropriate choices. And then what you can do, once you have your cat starting to go back in the boxes, you can start eliminating. It's like, I can't stand that one there. Mm. So this is a tough sell with a husband who's like, done, okay? But one thing I would suggest is you ask for a window of opportunity. Explain that I'm going to try something for 3 to 4 weeks. Can you hang in with me for another 3 to 4 weeks? That's one thing I would do. You might want to call somebody in, since this is life or death, to come in and do a house call. That can be really helpful. I've done house calls before, Larry, where I've basically come in and went, oh, your cat's looking out the window at stray cats. And that's causing him to want a scent mark because he feels insecure about holding onto his territory. So, you know, that's one possibility. You might not have been cleaning up. And when I say cleaning up, I don't mean just making the stain go away. I mean completely changing the odor so that it doesn't smell like urine anymore, because that's just a draw. And you have to get a black light. If your cat's going all over the house, the only way you can really truly neutralize all those areas is to get a black light.
I could have used you at about 2 o'clock in the morning one morning when I got up to go to the bathroom and walked out into the hardwood floor and stepped in and slipped on a big pile of, or a big area of cat urine.
Oh.
There's nothing like it, let me tell you.
Wakes you right up, doesn't it?
Oh, man.
Wakes you right up. So those are some very simple suggestions. But the one last thing I want to end with is, if you can't get it to work in this house, don't euthanize a cat. Take the cat to a humane society or to a rescue group. Explain that you have a problem with the cat marking. Yes, it decreases the cat's chance of being adopted. It does. But I have known individuals who mark like crazy in one context and not in another. So I don't think this has to be a life and death situation, okay?
Okay.
Surely there's another chance out there.
If somebody else has a question for us, Patricia, I hope they send us an email.
Just send us your question or advice to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call us, that number is 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Rachel in Superior, Wisconsin.
Well, Rachel, pleased to talk with you. What can we do for you?
We have two dogs, Lexi, who's a mutt, and she's 6 and perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a 10-month-old Great Dane named Vonnegut. And I just want to preface this by saying I've had Danes all my life, but I've never had one in puppy form. And Vonnegut, when he gets excited, likes to bite people's hands. And not bite, but he just kind of puts his mouth on there and kind of mouths people's hands. And that's fine for me because I can make him stop. But when people come over, Oh, they don't know what to do with a 130-pound puppy.
Oh, how old is he?
He's 10 months.
And he's at that adolescent age.
Yeah.
That free to a good home in the country age. Right. So I'm going to suggest two things. Mm-hmm. One is when he mouths someone else's hand, mm-hmm. you are going to yelp like he hurt you. You're going to say, ouch, or ouch. And so it's not, no, it's not this growly correction. It's, ow. Puppies, when they're growing up in the litter, they teach each other a certain amount of bite inhibition by biting on each other and then learning how the other reacts. Puppies at 5 weeks have no bite inhibition. They look like monsters, Larry. I watched a litter of Cairn Terriers once at 5 weeks old, and I thought, these are monsters. Then so they, as they play, though, this litter, as well as all dogs, learn about how to use their mouths with more finesse and how to not bite down sort of thoughtlessly. The second thing I want to suggest to you, I just learned at Wolf Park, which is a wonderful educational facility in Indiana. Wolf Park has an amazing group of wolves in a huge enclosure. And they take the puppies away from the litter early on, then put them back in with wolves at about 4 or 5 months, and so you can go in with the wolves. And one of the things they teach you is if they start mouthing on you, you are to put your hand, yes, inside their mouth and tickle the top, the roof of their mouth. Wow. I want you to just put your two fingers, your index and your other middle finger inside and just tickle the hard palate, the top of the roof of your dog's mouth. Dogs don't like it. And they tend to go away. You can also
try. They don't chomp down?
They shouldn't. I stopped when Larry said that because, like, 100% guarantee. Would I do this with a dog who has an aggression problem? No. No. Red flags are waving. No. Oh, you know, if it's really, really true that this is just sort of puppy-mouthy behavior, okay. Then I think that's a good thing to try. The other last thing, pat on the head. Pat, pat. Just pat, pat. Dogs don't like that either. They tend to go away.
Good luck. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate the call. 1-800-462-7413, the number for you to call to join in. Coming up next, discover what makes a zoo a good zoo. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. We're talking about zoos today, Tricia, and some say zoos are cruel, inhumane, they exploit animals. Other people find zoos educating and even inspiring. What should we keep in mind when we consider the ethics of zoos?
Well, you know, I would say the bottom line is that both of those perspectives that you gave, Larry, are right. In that bad zoos are, they really are. They're cruel, inhumane. They exploit animals just for the entertainment of people. Good zoos are wonderful things. I mean, they inspire people. They educate people. They promote conservation. And so I think that's the question is, you know, what makes a good zoo a good zoo and what makes a bad zoo a bad zoo?
Do you have an example of a good one?
I do. One of my favorite zoos in the world, actually, is the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum.
I don't know
how famous it is. It's south of Tucson. And what I love about it is, first of all, the animals are more important than anything. And I mean, I think that's the bottom line is, number one, the welfare, the psychological as well as the physical welfare of the animals is critical. And that just, you can see that in this museum. The animals live in habitats that are appropriate to the animals. And that's another thing that I think is so important, is not only do the animals live in appropriate habitats that they're adapted to, but people see them in their own in their own habitat. And they get this sense of an entire ecological system, you know, that everything's connected. It's not like a tiger in a cage over there and an elephant in a pen over there. They get a sense of how the whole ecosystem sort of fits together. And I think that's really important.
What about the animals, though? Are they suffering by being held in confinement?
Well, that's such an important question. I think the way to answer it is to remember that you just can't talk about animals as a big group. You know, what animals? People are always asking me, do animals think? Do animals do that? It's like, well, what animals? So look at it. Here's just one small example, Larry. If you compare being in confinement, if you're a prey animal versus if you're a predator animal, it's totally different. Try and look at the world for a minute from a prey animal's perspective.
Zebra, maybe.
Yeah, zebra, an antelope. You know, basically, prey animals, they want food, they want shelter, and they want water, and they want safety. So, you know, they don't, like, go on walks. You know, my sheep, for example, my sheep don't go, like, let's walk up behind the barn today. They just don't. They want safety. Whereas predators are like, let's all go on a walk. That's why we take our dogs on walk. That's why cats like to roam around. So it's very different. Are prey animals comfortable in confined small spaces? Probably a lot of them are if they feel safe.
Okay, so we have to understand each animal in order to evaluate their welfare.
That's right. And, you know, that's why it gets back to those priorities of good zoos, to education, understanding each animal and understanding how they fit into their environment. And that leads to a really important role of zoos, which is, again, being involved in conservation. You know, there's so many good zoos who do that. The St. Louis Zoo, the Brooklyn Zoo. They're out in other countries working really hard on not just preserving single animals, but whole ecosystems, and getting the people who live there involved, too.
Interesting. And if you want to learn more about what to look for in a good zoo, we'll post some websites on our website, Calling All Pets. What do you think of that?
Yeah, check it out. We'll put some interesting websites for you to learn more about the issue.
And you can join us with a question now at 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Bernard.
And where are you calling from, Bernard?
Washington, D.C.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with somebody from Washington, D.C. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm calling about two chocolate labs that I have. They're about 5.5 years old right now. And they seem to have a constant competition going on with one another whenever we go outside for walks or for runs in the park.
What do they do?
Well, they try to jockey for that front position.
I'm in the lead. No, I'm in the lead. No,
yes,
I'm in the
exactly.
lead.
Exactly. And if a squirrel comes through, both of them try to, of course, go for it, but one of them will either bark at the other and say, no, it's my squirrel.
Are these brothers?
They are half-brothers. They have the same father but different mothers, and they are about 8 weeks apart. One was born in July. The other one was born in the middle of August.
Gotcha. Pretty similar. Here's what I would try. Here's the first thing I would try is I would want to teach them a very kind of a matter-of-fact consequence for being silly and pushy. So basically, I would teach them what I call a flying lie down, which is not as hard as you think, especially with a Labrador. Is basically, you're going to teach them to just lie down wherever they are when you say so. And so you start one at a time. Don't try and teach them together. Teach one at a time. One of the things to keep in mind is that usually we tell dogs to lie down when they're facing us and we're facing them. And when you face them away from you, it completely changes the context. So you have to work your way up to that. You can't expect a dog 10 feet ahead of you walking away from you to lie down when you say it unless you work your way up in baby steps up to that kind of context. So
yeah.
First do it with the dog close to you and then move so the dog's facing a little bit away from you and then move so the dog's moving away from you. Slowly, step by step, baby steps. Do it one dog at a time, especially being sure to proof it outside and give them something great. You know, play is best if they love to play. Food is okay, too.
Okay.
So get that done. And then every time they start to get, figure out what your line is and be as consistent as you can. Okay, a little bit of shoulder bumping is okay, but once you start barking, it's okay. Like, that's just, I'm not going to tolerate that anymore. So as soon as they do, you say, lie down. And then you wait for 10 seconds, and then you let them up again. They started to get, lie down. And basically, they're, you know, they're smart dogs, and they're going to be like, yeah, it's boring.
Exactly. <You
know? laughs> So that's going to take a lot of training on your part.
Okay.
But I think it's very much worth it. Here's these wonderful opportunities to have these off-leash walks and these great parks they have in D.C. Larry, did you know D.C. is this great place to have a dog?
I did not know that.
It has all these great dog parks in it. So you want, you know, they want to be able to enjoy being there. So try this. The other thing I'd want you to think about is at home, I want you to pay a little bit more attention about what's going on in the house. Do you start to pet one dog and another one comes in and sort of pushes in front, says like, no, pet me?
No, really, they Well, actually, sometimes. But for the most part, they stay in completely different areas.
Oh.
No.
Yeah, the one dog wants to be near the family. The other dog wants to, because the other dog is with the family. He's like, okay, I'm going to go hang out somewhere else.
Oh, there's a lot of competition going on, it sounds like. You might want to call in a really great trainer or behaviorist to come in and just go on a walk with you and sort of help you figure out what's going on.
Okay.
Sounds like an interesting. Larry, let's go to D.C.
Yeah,
I want
like
to do
that.
A doggy nanny call.
Please come.
Yeah, I'd love to.
You can come to our zoo.
We'll see if the producer will send us.
Thanks, Bernard. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Appreciate your call. Tricia, we recently spoke with Janice in Norfolk, Virginia, who was wondering how to get her deaf dog's attention when she's not in the dog's line of sight. Remember that? We had several listeners write in with their own ideas to help alleviate the problem. Many listeners pointed out that vibrating collars are available for purchase online. They work like a pager. They don't give you a shock. They just vibrate. And Janice can use a remote control to get her dog's attention by causing the collar to vibrate. Also, a couple of listeners suggested using laser pointers. Laser lights could be used almost anywhere, even in daylight, to get the dog's attention. And finally, Pauline in Harwood, Maryland, recalled Janice's concerns about her young grandchild possibly sneaking up on the dog. She wonders if the child could wear a scent or a scented clothing item when she visits so the dog will smell the child in advance of seeing her. What do you think, Patricia?
Oh, man, these are such good ideas. And the first one, the vibrating collar, it's like, I know that.
Why didn't I?
Where was my brain? Thank you, listeners, for saving me. That's such a great idea. And I'm listening like, where was I during this phone call? So yay, listeners. That's a wonderful idea. I love the vibrating collar. And yes, you can get collars that it's not like a shock, as long as you're sure that you use them correctly. Absolutely. I love the idea of the scent on the child. Although, one of the things to keep in mind is that if the airflow is moving away from the dog, it doesn't matter how good their nose is.
Oh,
a lot
okay.
of people think dogs can smell anything, anywhere, anytime. It's actually not true. They have to get the actual molecules have to move inside their nose and set off certain receptors. So if the airflow is moving away from the dog, away from the child, that still wouldn't work. And one quick caution about the laser pointers, I think with a lot of dogs, that's a really good idea. But I have this big caution as a behaviorist. I've seen, I'm trying to count up. I've seen a lot of dogs who became literally obsessive, first about the laser lights, and then it turns into the car lights or a reflection off the oven door when you open it. And I've had clients who have dogs who literally stare at the wall for hours and won't move. And some are so bad that they'll bite you if you try and get them to move.
Careful about that one.
Lasers make me twitchy. That's my one. They work great for some dogs, but not for others.
Okay. But those are, we had some great tips.
Oh, we love it. Please send us more. And, you know, you can go on our website and contact us through that. Just go to callingallpets.org.
And if you'd like to join us by phone, the number to call 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, just great. Thank you for calling. Who are we speaking with?
My name is Charlie.
And where are you from, Charlie?
I'm in Richmond, Illinois, up near the Wisconsin-Illinois border.
Well, I tell you what, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I had a couple of things. First of all, I really love your show, and I would like for you to encourage people to continue to adopt pets from the shelters. That's where we've got our last two dogs.
Good
and
for you.
Our latest addition is Katrina. She's a refugee from Louisiana. So my question is regarding her behavior. She was very skittish at first and afraid of balls and squeaky toys. But now she plays with her squeaky toys, and one squeaky toy in particular she howls at when she bites it. And we can't figure, you know, it was so bizarre. It's so cute, this low, moaning, mournful howl. and she sounds so sad. And after a while, she keeps biting and squeaking it and howling at it, and finally starts barking and yipping at it like she's aggravated. But we just wondered, I thought maybe this might be frustration. I'm killing you. Why don't you die? Somebody else suggested that perhaps she misses the puppy that she was found with when she was rescued. And so I just wondered what your take on that might be.
Wow. Wow. There's some dogs who are very vocal. They respond to lots of different stimuli by vocalizing. And there are a lot of sounds that can set off howling. You know, there are particular frequencies. I had a Border Collie, Larry. I could hit high C. Mm-hmm. We had a piano in the house at that point. And if you hit high C, Drift would start.
Just on high C.
Only thing you could do to get him howling. But every time you hit high C, he'd start to howl. So, you know, it might be it's just that particular frequency that for some reason just turns the right neurons on, and it just sort of stimulates the other right neurons in the vocal center of a dog's brain, and off she goes. And then the barking later, that often is related to dogs who are aroused. They're emotionally aroused. They're excited. And sometimes they are barking because they're frustrated. So I think frustration is possible. In terms of what emotion she has when she's howling, keep in mind that howling is not necessarily indicative of a sad kind of emotion. Mm-hmm. So I don't worry that your dog is sad necessarily when she's howling at her squeaky toy.
Charlie, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very, very much. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Coming up next, we'll hear about the dramatic rescue of the wild horses from a missile testing range in New Mexico. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Dr. Don Hoagland to the program. Don is an equine veterinarian and the author of the book Nobody's Horses, The Dramatic Rescue of the Wild Herd of White Sands. Don, welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure to be here.
First, tell us about White Sands. Where is it and what is it?
White Sands is a national monument in southern New Mexico, just a few miles north out of El Paso, Texas. But it encompasses 4,000 square miles, or 2 million acres, of some of the most beautiful, harsh, high desert in the country. It's south of Albuquerque, New Mexico, a few hours. And it is the place where our very first nuclear age was brought into play, at this place called Trinity Site. It's a place that was taken from the ranchers, some 40 ranching families, in 1942, as what was originally White Sands Proving Ground, to test aerial bombardment for the British to repay Hitler for the bombardment of London. And as history would have it, it grew from a few hundred thousand acres into 2 million over the course of just a few years. And it is a very secretive place. In fact, I would say it's the most secretive place in the United States right now.
And yet, there were all these horses at White Sands. How did they get to be there in the first place in that kind of situation?
White Sands Missile Range, because of where it lies in the west, southwest of the United States, is a microcosm of the Old West. Famous outlaws, Billy the Kid to be one, Black Jack Ketchum, as well as famous lawmen like Sheriff Pat Garrett, all lived in this area. In fact, Sheriff Pat Garrett had a ranch right in the middle of what is now White Sands Missile Range. That being the case, in that because it is a microcosm of the Old West, there were naturally lots of horses around. Some of the famous cattle drive trails went right next to this area called White Sands. the Chisholm Trail being one of them. So naturally, we would have a lot of very good quality West Texas horses at the turn of the century.
So the book is about a rescue that I know you were a key player in. Describe the situation at White Sands that necessitated a rescue of all these horses.
In the late 1970s, rains were favorable for this area in the high desert, and when we have good rain, there was plenty of forage available. And so the some 200 or 300 head of horses roaming freely on White Sands Missile Range blossomed into 1,000 head of horses. And the military knew at the time that something had to be done. This is a dangerous place. And although they're very conscious of the environment at White Sands Missile Range, intensely so, I might add, they decided that they had to do something and start paring these horses down. Animal rights activists in Southern California became enraged when there was going to be a capture for auction of some horses in the late 1980s, and that stopped the harvesting of even 100 head of horses coming into 1990. By 1994, a drought, a normal 10-year drought, had ensued, and here we have a die-off which began this story. 122 horses showed up dead around a single watering hole 35 miles in the most dangerous place in the United States, and 90 minutes of radio silence back to headquarters took the wildlife biologists that found the horses, only to find out that the Dallas Morning News already knew about it.
Wow.
How I became involved is I saw a newspaper article and knew the stories, being a practitioner of veterinary medicine in Santa Fe over the years, the decade before that. And I knew that there was a problem down at White Sands, tried to help in the late 1980s. And no resolution came as a result of too many forces, too many political entities involved in what would happen. So I see this article about the die-off, and the concern that I had was for the dead horses lying at the bottom of the pitcher. But as being a veterinarian, I saw the perfectly healthy baby horses in that pitcher is what drew my attention to something drastically went wrong at this place, White Sands.
And I tell you what, 1,800 horses in an area that large, and to round those horses up had to be, and as I read in your book, it was quite a process. And maybe you could talk about some of the techniques you and your team had to develop in order to round up these herds. And although there were 1,800 horses, they were actually in several herds. They weren't all running around together.
That's exactly right, Larry. There were four main herd groups. The northern herd were predominantly draft horse, blood horses from the Three Rivers area where they plowed sugar beets. The middle and central area where the die-off was were actually Pat Garrett's own personal horses, left for 80-some years. In the west was a Rhodes Canyon herd owned by the famous Eugene Manlove Rhodes of Little Eohippus fame. And in the southern part were just a collection of various different horses. So in order to capture them, we had to know that I had to use equine behavior in order to talk them into going to a specific direction. These horses were not afraid of aircraft. They were quite used to helicopters and F-117A stealth fighter craft. And so something had to be done to try and talk them into one window of opportunity and get them to go that way. And if it felt to them that we were pushing them in that direction, they would reject it and often go scatter as would quail. So the danger of it started with the military presence itself. There's a lot of unspent ordnance, even though the military did its very best to clean up. There's unspent ordnance all the way back to World War II. That was the first challenge. The next challenge is that it's a highly protected cultural and environmental place, so that there were only certain places you could go. And if you got near a place you couldn't go, you were told immediately. It was just like some kind of aerial bombing mission or reconnaissance mission. There were areas you could go and areas you couldn't go. You're right, Larry, when you say that this seems like a vast area. We called these horses down there 60-40 horses. That meant that they could run 60 miles an hour and run and had a mouth 40 feet wide in order to eat enough on this kind of desert. But in good areas, they really did quite well.
We haven't even talked about being on the ground handling these huge animals where you have to vaccinate, castrate, do all these procedures. I know there was a vet who had her hand skinned, basically. You almost got killed at one point.
I can suggest that I was almost killed that time. It was my own fault. I was staring about into the sky thinking about what a great job we were doing when a herd turned back on me. But it was dangerous to be near a horse that runs anywhere up to 1,800 pounds when in good flesh. They're extraordinarily scared of you. They don't want you touching them. They don't like two-legged creatures because it always seems they get hurt when they're near them. They don't want to be anywhere around you, and they know how to bite. When they bite, they almost never spit out what it is they bit off.
they chew. And their skin, as you say, is so sensitive. In your book, you say that they know even when a fly lands on their skin.
Certainly they do. The horse has a cutaneous trunci muscle just underneath the skin on certain parts of its body, and they can feel a fly. But interesting with the horses, especially the stallions, they had real thick neck skin, and I needed to get to the jugular vein in order to draw blood samples to be sure that when we removed the horses from the missile range and took them into the general public, that we weren't carrying any odd diseases or strange toxicities with us.
Where did these horses end up after they were captured?
The plan was strategized for several weeks before we effected a captured strategy. And that was that we would capture these horses in a natural enclosure as best we could, so that because they knew this area, it was less stressful. It would be a natural corralling for them. Then we would take the horses after doing all the paperwork, bringing in all the federal and state agencies that had a part to play in this, and they were very good, from wildlife officials to state livestock board. We were going to take them to a place that already had the respect of animal rights and animal welfare groups across the nation, in just north of Bartlesville, Oklahoma, where the Department of Interior's free-roaming horse unadoptables go to. So we made a plan with them to bring the horses there and then to reintroduce them, when we were sure everybody was healthy, back into normal ranch life. After all, that's where they came from.
Don, you wrote about the 1971 Wild Free-Roaming Horse and Burro Act, and I know that was an act that was supposed to protect wild horses from capture, especially from being used in the commercial meat market. Do wild horses still have similar protection today?
I would like to use the words free-roaming horses rather than wild.
Okay.
Because as soon as I say the word wild, we enter an argument about, are these actually wild animals? To me, it doesn't matter whether they're termed wild or not. When you get up close to them, they're as wild as they ever were 1.5 million years ago. But no one argues, and thank goodness that the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burro Act was named with free roaming in there. They are, in fact, free roaming horses. That argument about wildness then goes away, and we can move into the other pertinent questions. Pertinent question being is, were they protected in 1971? To a great extent, they were protected from commercial slaughter, and there were penalties for capturing and slaughtering free-roaming horses. But remember, it only protected horses on Department of Interior lands at that time where the horses were actively living in 1971. So if those lands changed, it didn't protect the horses. All the horses are considered feral, being once domesticated, gone loose. The issue is, are all free-roaming horses protected? And the answer is no, because we have horses that are free-roaming on tribal lands. We might call them privately owned, but they're state park lands that are not covered under the Wild Free-Roaming Horses and Burro Act. Now, in 2004, Conrad Burns, who no longer is employed with the Senate of the United States, slid a rider into the 2005 Consolidated Appropriations Act to remove the commercial slaughter protections for some of those horses, being those over 10 years old and horses that went through the adoption process three times and weren't adopted. But really, the language said that all of those horses that were in captivity could be captured and used for commercial purposes.
Which you're not in favor of, I'm certain. What solutions do you propose?
I believe there are solutions, but let me suggest that I am guilty in the beginning. I worked for 7 years happily with Bill Richardson, who was then Congressman in the North District in New Mexico, and everybody knows his history and biography now. We worked and developed from a pilot program in Canyon City, Colorado, to train free-roaming horses inside the penal system. Inmates would learn to handle an inherently violent situation without violence. Having gone through that process and for those 7 years and helped some 4,000 inmates to understand that they don't need violence to operate in their lives, we also put out into the domestic market somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 head of horses. I today suggest that we need to stop capturing these horses for adoption unless it's absolutely necessary. We need to manage these horses in the wild. You will find that wildlife biologists, federal, state, local, all believe that the horses should be managed in the wild, and there are methods and avenues to do that.
Well, you've written a fascinating book, Don, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Both of us appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Larry and Patricia.
Don Hoagland is the author of Nobody's Horses, The Dramatic Rescue of the Wild Herd of White Sands. He joined us today from the studios of WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Don's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And now it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, call our 800 number or send us an email to pets@wpr.org. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Nobody's Horses by Don Hoagland. And here's today's question. Mustangs are often referred to as wild horses, but the more correct term is feral horses. Today, the only true wild horse is the Przewalski's horse, native to which Asian country, Central Asian country? If you think you know the answer, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. To find out if you're correct, visit callingallpets.org and we'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week or so. And if you'd like to join in right now with a question, the number is 1-800-462-7413. And let's take a call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Gabe in Dallas.
Dallas, Texas. Gabe, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, you were talking about feral horses. I have a feral cat. Well, it's my partner's. His cat, ever since it was a kitten, has just gotten more and more wild. And she likes Matt and I, but she, as she's become an adult, she won't let anybody pet her, but she's not afraid of people.
Is she an inside cat, or is she outside a lot?
Inside. She's afraid to go outside, actually.
Oh, okay.
And when people come over, she's not afraid of them. She'll walk right up to them, but if they reach down to pet her, she swats at them.
No, don't pet me. One of the things to keep in mind is that there's a large percentage of cats, almost as though cats are digital. You know, there's a cat's like, I cannot be petted enough. You know, rub me, rub me, rub me, rub me. And then there are the other cats who are, I'd like to be with you, but I'm just not cuddly. Thank you very much. So if the cat's okay, then I would just say, you know, I'm not going to define this as a problem.
Okay.
And I don't know, you can get a little stuffed cat and give it to your visitors to pet. You know, here's actually, I know somebody who did that. They had a cat who could actually get a little bit aggressive if people tried to pet the cat, but it was one of those beautiful, just gorgeous, magnetic cats that you just wanted to get your hand, long-haired, beautiful markings, great color, and would come right up to you, and it was really hard for people to not pet this cat, So I can't remember her name. I think it was Colleen. She bought a stuffed cat. And people would come over and she'd say, here, pet this. So that's one possibility. But again, if the cat really doesn't want it, and as long as you're getting what you want, I would just decide it's not a problem.
Yeah, that's kind of what we've done. Well, I appreciate it, Patricia.
Thanks very much for calling, Gabe.
Thank you, Larry. I listen to you guys all the time.
Oh, thanks. Oh,
thanks a lot. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you'd like to join in. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Matthew from Boise, Idaho.
Matthew, hi. Thank you for calling.
You bet. I've got a question. We have a neighbor's dog, we're not sure exactly who likes to come over and use our backyard instead of the neighbor's.
And I'll bet I know for what.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the unpleasant business of the day.
Right.
And we've tried... We're trying to do this humanely since we can't figure out whose dog it is and actually knock on the door and say, hey, you know, take care of this issue for us, please. We've tried using cayenne pepper. One of our friends suggested putting a line of that where the dog's coming into the backyard, and that didn't seem to make any difference.
Mm.
I'm wondering if there's anything else we can do. I don't want to use a trap or something that's going to hurt the dog.
Yeah. You know, there is a device you can buy at shops that sell electronics. It's one of those boundary alarm systems, basically. And there are two different versions I've seen for animals. One basically shoots a light, just like the light goes across on your automatic garage door or opener or something like that. So it shoots a light across, and if that stream of light is broken, then either a loud noise goes off, which often will scare a lot of dogs. They have no idea what it was, and they'll run back in the other direction, run back home. So that's one possibility. The other thing to remember if you're using something like Pepper is that's only going to work if they have their noses down on the ground. So a dog just trotting over dirt that has Pepper in it, not going to do anything.
Yeah. Okay.
But if you put Pepper where the dog tends to go to the bathroom, does it tend to go in the same place every time?
Yeah.
There you go. That's where you want to put the Pepper.
Okay.
Because that's when dogs put their noses down and start sniffing. So he just might go 10 feet away, still on your property.
Yeah.
But that's something to consider, too.
And if you want to identify the animal, you might also try one of these night cameras, motion cameras, that you can set up outside. Maybe you can borrow one from a friend or
yeah, you'll need a couple $1,000, right?
Well, no, they're about $200-$300.
Is that all?
Yeah, you can get them now for that price.
Oh, wow, that's inexpensive.
You might just, if you want to identify the dog in question,
if they don't know,
you could
who
do
it
that
is,
you could
yeah.
set that up outside, and it actually takes pictures when it senses motion,
and then you've got proof. That's a great idea, Larry. And you know, here's one other idea that's not quite as high tech. My idea has no cool factor whatsoever, which is that you wait for the dog to go to the bathroom in your backyard, and then you scoop it up with a scooper, and you keep putting it. You don't just get rid of it. You put it off your yard, outside of your yard, on somebody else's yard, or some other area where you don't mind that the dog goes, because they do tend to go sometimes over that same area.
Place.
So you could move the problem rather than eliminating it, and then put Pepper where he used to go. She used to go, whoever. That might work. Give that a try, too.
Give it a shot. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you'd like to join in. Patricia, a listener named Newbold in Alexandria, Virginia, emailed us asking the following question. I'm a textile conservator and work from a home-based studio located on the lower level of our home. I'm up and down the stairs many times during the course of a day, and sometimes I welcome private clients into my studio. The problem is that when I'm headed down the stairs, my 16-month-old white German Shepherd, Lily, races ahead, pushing past me and everyone else on the stairs. Then when going up the stairs, she will push past and stop halfway up and not move. I have to shove her to get her to keep moving. Once Lily is in the studio, she's very well behaved, goes off into her corner, lies down. She's excellent company during the day, and I enjoy having her with me while I do my work. I don't want to banish her from the studio. How do I keep her from becoming a tripping hazard?
Well, this is a fun one. I really like this one because it's very fixable. And it also reminds us that their dogs are named shepherds for a reason. you know, German shepherds were bred to move animals from here to there and to establish sort of living fences, basically, where there was really no fence, but keep sheep out of the neighbor's field. So I love this herding behavior is basically going on. But this is an easy one. All I want you to do is I want you to teach your dog that when you approach the stairway, she is to sit on the top of it while you go down. She sits and waits, and then you say, okay, and she runs down behind you. And that's not that hard. No, it's not that hard at all. You're going to use something she loves, toys or treats. I would start with little tiny treats that you could give her 20 of in one training session, because you want to do this over and over and over again to get her the idea. And you simply don't do this when they're company there. You know, make it simple and easy for her to be right. And you're going to approach the stairs. I want you to, if she's ahead of you already, I want you to throw some treats behind you. And then I would use wait. I would use the signal wait. I use that all the time. It means just pause for a second. You could use sit, stay, too. So what I want you to do is I want you to say wait, and then use your body. This is a shepherd. She's going to be very, very attentive to you sort of managing the space around her. You don't have to touch her, but I want you to say wait. Throw your arms out like a traffic cop.
Mm-hmm.
And if she starts to, and you want to turn a little bit to start to walk down the stairs, and as she starts to get up, you're going to turn back, put your hands up again like a traffic cop, sort of move forward to block that space again. good girl, good girl. And then you're not going to go all the way down the stairs. That's too hard at first.
So you just go down a couple of steps or?
Even, yeah, maybe one. Maybe not even go down any steps at first. You're going to go back and you're going to give her a treat as she's there waiting patiently. Good girl. Good girl. Okay, release her. And then approach the stairs again. Make sure you're in between. Wait. You could, good girl, good girl. One step. You're going down one step and you come back again. And then gradually you get so that she's waiting at the top of the stairway until you're all the way down the stairs. And then you say, okay. And it's not that hard to train. You can train this in a week.
Wow.
It's, yeah, this is an easy one.
Well, if that is so easy, I bet there's a lot of people who have questions out there who would say, gosh, if that's easy, what about my problem?
Oh, and I hope you all call in with lots of easy problems because I love easy problems. But you know what? It's fascinating to get the whole range of them. So don't hesitate. Bring it on. We're ready.
Bring it on. And you can email us at?
You can email us at pets@wpr.org.
And I tell you what, we're going to be back next week, aren't we?
We are indeed. And we'll get more great calls next week.
We sure hope so. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0209P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.